this gold Porsche almost ran me over. And it was Ellen. You know, I recently watched the Blackberry movie and thought, this is boring. My movie would be way better. We had some hilarious moments. We had a lot more fun than they had in on Phillip Street. We went down this course of, instead of paying for influencers, we just stalked them. It's much more financially efficient and, but weird. And trying to be frugal often lands you in weird scenarios.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first. Just like songs and a mixtape, it creates something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Tricia Mumby, storyteller, entrepreneur, and mentor to early-stage startups. Tricia is honest and vulnerable as she shares tough lessons from co-founding Mabel's Labels with three best friends in a basement to selling it to the largest label company in the world. I love Tricia's take on celebrating failure, keeping your innovative spirit alive as your business grows, being shameless, and how she's worked to overcome imposter syndrome. How did Tricia end up with Sheryl Crow's guitar and almost get run over by Ellen DeGeneres? Please enjoy Tricia Mumby. Welcome, Tricia. This is super exciting. I can't wait to get started. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
No problem. I'm excited to be your first guest.
I know. Well, and so I've got obviously a ton of questions, but one thing that you and I, we were chatting yesterday in preparation for this, and one thing you mentioned in passing that I had totally forgotten about, and I'm going to ask you about right off the top, because I don't want to forget. How did you end up with Sheryl Crow's guitar?
Well, I went to an event called, I can't remember what it was called, but it was an event that Inc. magazine used to put on, and it was awesome. And it really had no agenda, it had no theme, and you just sat at the Grand Ole Opry with all entrepreneurs. You had to be a founder. You had to fill out a little quiz. And because it was in Nashville, one of the sponsors was Sony Music, and they put up a bunch of new artists in front of us to get to know us. And like, I met Dan and Shay also. I met the guy from Drunk on a Plane. Like, I met a bunch of guys that were not famous yet. And it was awesome. And so anyway, they had this Twitter thing, like the first person to tweet the answer to whatever. And of course, I'm pretty fast at Twitter and I'm very competitive. I'm a winner. I win things. I'm a contester. I play contests every day. I enter a contest every day, often win. So I won. And so I got to go backstage and all those artists were back there. And they were awesome. And the prize was a signed guitar from Sheryl Crow. And I don't play guitar, but I have never, ever been cooler than walking through the Nashville airport with a guitar case. I was going to give the guitar away and get the guitar case retrofitted into a laptop case just so I could feel that cool every day. And I didn't do it. But one day, maybe I will. It was pretty cool.
That's awesome. I do remember you telling me that story. When you mentioned the Drunk on a Plane, I think it continues to this day, maybe because of that story, to be one of your favorite songs. And you were telling me about this song because I don't think anybody had heard it, as you mentioned. And I'm like, what a ridiculous, terrible song. And of course, now it's like a country classic.
There was another guy too that's now really famous. And I can never remember his name until he comes on the radio. And I'm like, I met that guy. And Dan and Shay, of course, had become really famous.
Remind me, what happened to the guitar?
I gave it to a friend who was raising money for the breast cancer walk in Toronto. So she had a raffle for it and sold tickets on it. And so somebody in Kitchener has it, and she raised a lot of money with it.
Right. Interesting. As you know, I do play guitar, but I guess it didn't occur to you to slide it my way.
I think I did offer it to you, actually. It was too small for you or something. You're very particular.
All right. That does sound vaguely familiar. All right. I've given a lot of thought to the things that we want to talk about today. I made a list. I think this is going to have to be a series of podcasts. So maybe you're going to be one of those people on SNL that comes back like five times, because we've got much more than we could ever cover today. You know, full disclosure, you've been a coach and a mentor to me. And it's a big reason why we're here today. This podcast wouldn't be happening without kind of your encouragement and support. So that's amazing. And I know, despite you being shameless at some things, which we'll talk about later on, I know you're also quite humble. So you probably don't want to hear me talk about how awesome you are and what a big part of my life you are. But so let's talk then about Mabel's Labels. Yep. This is the story of you and three of your best friends starting a label company in a basement and selling it to the largest label company in the world. And when I think about that, I'm wondering, when you think about that entire journey, what are those moments that when you look back and reflect on it, bring you the most joy?
Oh, so many. I mean, we have had some hilarious, you know, I recently watched the Blackberry movie and thought, this is boring. My movie would be way better. We had some hilarious moments. We had a lot more fun than they had on Phillip Street. We had huge ups and downs, but tons and tons of ups, ridiculous situations. I once almost got ran over by Ellen DeGeneres and went to her studio. I had a meeting with her marketing people, and I thought I was going to get to meet her, and I didn't. And I left through this back alleyway, and I was really sad. And this gold Porsche almost ran me over, and it was Ellen. I've met tons of celebrities, and been in weird situations with celebrities, and things. I'm like, what the hell is Children's Labels? How did that happen? We went down this course of, instead of paying for influencers, we just stopped them. It's much more financially efficient but weird. And trying to be frugal often lands you in weird scenarios. Somebody recently asked me that though. And one of my favorite stories or favorite memories of Mabel is, one of the things I take great pride in is becoming an excellent employer. We take a lot of pride in, we were an excellent place to work. And there was this woman, Paula, who still works at Mabel. And she came to us from a temp agency, and she worked for us every summer through the temp agency. And they don't get paid a lot at the temp agency, because the temp agency takes, you know, I'm sure you know. But we love Paula. And I always said, if I ever have a spot for another full-timer, year-rounder in production, I'm going to hire Paula. And one day it happened. And I said, Paula, called her into my office, and I said, we have a full-time position for you. And she started to cry. She had never had benefits. She had never had been able to go to the dentist. She'd never had benefits for her kid. She was a single mom living in Hamilton, getting screwed around by temp agencies. And it was one of the loveliest moments. And I recently went back to Mabel for the 20th anniversary, and Paula was there, and she's still it made an impression on her too. And just the gratitude and the happiness that some of our long-term employees have had. And certainly there are people that maybe are disgruntled, and maybe someone will listen to this and say, no, she was terrible to work for. And that's fine. You know, not everyone's a fit for the culture we had, but the people, we have a lot of long-term employees and that are very, very grateful. And we've had a lot of fun. So Paula, I'd say Paula is one of my things I remember most.
That's amazing. 20 years. What was that like?
It was weird because I no longer work there. We sold the business. And since I left in 2020, they did a gigantic renovation. It looks beautiful and fancy, and spent all kinds of money that I wouldn't have spent, and made decisions. Like, one of the things when I left that I didn't really want to do was live through that renovation. And that was part of one of the things that made me leave when I did. And so Karma, who took over my job, made fabulous decisions. Like, it looked amazing. And it was fun to see some people stuck around after I left. But honestly, there were so many strangers, and that was weird.
It's interesting, even listening to you talk about it, you still use the term we a lot, like you're still there, right? It's a little mix of, and I guess that'll change over time, but
I don't know. I still send them the odd email, like, I just saw this on the website and that's wrong. You need to, I'm still a bit of a tip giver. Once there will be a day where I don't know anyone there and I will stop doing that.
I wonder, and maybe it's some of the work that I do is customer journey mapping and stuff. And so I think of your journey at Mabel's visually, and I map it out from, you know, four friends in a basement to the big exit. And so you can map those moments of joy along that journey and with green poker chips. What are some of the hardest moments that you would put maybe in red poker chips along that journey that stand out?
It's funny you say that, because we actually had a wall in our old boardroom of exactly that. We put every single year and every big milestone, and we only put the happy ones. Mm. You know, we learned the hard way. We really wanted to be in retail. We had some advisors tell us, you're never going to make it in America unless you get the Walmart mom, the mom that will never buy online, the mom that has to see you on a store shelf to understand you and trust you. And so we put a ton of work into that. Like, I went to China twice to look at factories and figure out how to make these labels and how to import them. And we worked really hard and paid a lot of consultants to get into meetings with Walmart executives. We went to Target, to Target head office. It was a lot of work, and we did it. We landed it. We thought we were laughing. And we learned the hard way that retail is a nightmare, and I'll never do it again. You know, we sold millions and millions of dollars worth of labels into Walmart, and most of them got returned to us. We had skids and skids of labels back in our warehouse one day. And the same thing can happen with Amazon too. I see a lot of my current customers. I work as a mentor now for direct consumer businesses, and everybody thinks that retail is the holy grail and Amazon is going to save their life. And it is not. It's a dark place only because we wanted it so bad. It's something we, you know, sort of like Oprah's favorite things, which is the second most disappointing thing, that we wanted really bad and couldn't get. It's just one of the things that, like, we managed to get press in everything we ever wanted. I want to be in Good Housekeeping. I want to be in the Wall Street Journal. I want to be, okay, maybe we didn't do that. But we were in Forbes. We were in every parenting magazine, People magazine, like, monthly, because of our celebrities stalking. But we couldn't get into Oprah's favorite things. And we tried every year to the point that one of Oprah's producers finally phoned us and said, who are you? And why do we keep getting mail from you? What is happening here? He said, we really want to be Oprah's favorite thing. How does it work? Give us a scoop. And we kind of knew how it worked. And she said, you're never going to be Oprah's favorite thing. She doesn't do children's things. And I said, you're wrong. She has done. And, you know, I knew exactly what had always been Oprah's favorite things. Okay. But it's also not expensive enough. And I said, oh, which labels did I send you? And she said, oh, they're pink and blue. And I said, oh, I meant to send you the Swarovski crystal labels. They're selling for 15 labels for $75 US. I'm sorry. Someone has made a mistake. I'm going to get those to you right away. That was utter bullshit. Immediately hang up the phone, get my product development person in. You need to go to Toronto and find little tiny Swarovski crystals, find some airplane glue, maybe buy a mask. This sounds dangerous. Tweezers. And we created labels that don't really exist. Figured we went to some store and found some bougie packaging and pretended that's how it was going to be packaged, made a fake product page for it. I think we might have even made a fake website URL for it just so it really looked legit. And they did call back and said, we got them. Okay, we're going to consider them. And no, didn't happen. We were never Oprah's favorite thing.
When you talk about the influencer, you mentioned that a couple of times. I don't think that was actually a thing back then, was it?
It wasn't. No.
Like, remind people of when you were doing this. There was Facebook. How was the social media landscape?
It was really blogs, and mommy bloggers were coming up. And then some celebrity mommies were having blogs, like Lisa Rinna and Brooke Shields at the time were kind of hot. We got both of them to write about us and thank us publicly. And Twitter was instrumental for that. We'd be able to figure out who their assistants were, who their real life friends were. You know, Lisa Rinna owned part of a baby store on Rodeo Drive. So you could just figure out how to get mail to them by figuring out who they were connected to on Twitter. Now social media is so enormous, it's much harder. But when everything was really small, it was easier. And what really, really blew us up, like a life-changing day for me that I'll never forget, is the day that we were in a blog called the Daily Candy. And the Daily Candy, we didn't even know anything about it. I basically came home from work one day and from my job at University of Waterloo. And my husband said, Cynthia, my partner who did production and was on mat leave at the time, Cynthia has called a dozen times saying that you've got a virus. You've got to deal with it. Call Cynthia back. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have a shower. Whatever. I'll deal with it later. Get out of the shower. Joe's standing at the door. You've got to call Cynthia. She's called again. Your website has a virus. I'm like, okay. So I opened my mail and there were hundreds of orders. And I was like, oh my God, we do have a virus. Like, at the time we were getting like 5 orders a week. And so I called the website guy who built our website in exchange for a foosball table. Kevin, we got a problem. We've got a virus. Every time I hit F5, more orders come in. Somebody's making fake orders on our website. And he looked at them and said, those are real. So I started looking at them and I made myself count to 10 and then hit F5. More orders would come in. It was just amazing. And so some of the comments said the Daily Candy. And then one order said, you know, the woman's name. And in the comments, I told the Daily Candy about you. I hope you're busy. Call her. Who are you? Well, she lived in Santa Monica and she had connections to the editors at the Daily Candy. And the Daily Candy at the time was the hottest blog, but they had no editorial masthead. You could not send them things. You could not know who was in charge of it. The writers were anonymous. They had to find you. But this woman knew how to get to them. And I said, well, how did you hear about us? Well, she had just been visiting a friend or a cousin in Ottawa, and we had just been in Canadian Living magazine because of a friend of mine that went to journalism school, like blah, 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 blah. Well, every celebrity, everybody who was anybody in New York or LA got the Daily Candy at the time. The who's who started ordering them, and they are, even though they weren't called influencers, they're all influential. What they're wearing, what they're doing, what they're buying. We all had to call in sick from our day jobs and make labels around the clock. We all had babies. We had to stuff the babies in the corner and occasionally feed them. And on this next day, we got a call from Global News heard about us somehow through the Daily Candy. And we also got a call from Martha Stewart's producers. We're wondering if you guys would like to be on Martha Stewart next week. Yes, we would. We would very much like that. Great. Send us a headshot. We will. Hang up. Scream. Freak out. Google what is a headshot. Go to a photographer. These photos are so bad. We've been up for days making labels. Those photos are infamously horrendous. But on the Monday, we were getting ready to go to New York. That she got indicted. The show got canceled.
Oh.
Didn't go see Martha Stewart either.
I'm digging those photos up.
They're in my, I have a Mabel scrapbook with all the worst photos.
So what the, when I think about that journey, and I guess I'm thinking about the latter part of that journey with Mabel, it's such a unique opportunity to, as I said, you know, start off with nothing, have a really successful exit, but you actually stayed on for a couple of years afterwards. Mm-hmm. You talked about the kind of guerrilla tactics that you'd use to just do crazy things and invent things and figure your way through challenges, that super agile, exciting whole startup world, and then land yourself in the largest label company in the world. What was that experience like?
Well, as we got bigger, I mean, we had naturally started to get less risky. Some of us anyway, some of my partners, some of our employees, you know, my crazy ideas weren't always the most popular. I mean, we still squeeze some through, but I feel like that's something that happens to companies as you grow up. You know, I remember once, mm-hmm. you know, we were pushing maybe 50 or 60 employees, 50 or 60 families are relying on paychecks from us. You naturally just get a little more risk averse. But big giant companies are a whole other level of risk averse. Part of our deal was one of us had to stay on to run the business. So I stayed on as the GM and I was there for 3 years, I feel like. And it was fun while it was fun. But I focus on the fun things. So there were lots of perks. You know, CCL is an amazing company with factories all over the world. They print everything. They print our money. They print Australia's money. They print the euro. They print every container. We all have things around us that are made by CCL, I promise you, in every room of your house. And so I got to go into all these factories. And, you know, if your company was doing well every year, you got invited to this very bougie trip in wonderful places around the world. And I flew in a private plane and like really cool things and met some amazing people. When the perks kind of dried up during COVID, I realized this is actually a tremendous amount of pressure for a lot less joy than it used to be. They said they liked the experimental ideas. They said they enjoyed my energy, but really I would take my energy into some rooms and they would nod and smile and then walk away. Like nothing would ever happen with it. And I mean, I could still do some things with Mabel, but I don't know. It just wasn't the same. I'm built for small companies, and that's why I love mentoring right now. That's why I absolutely love what I'm doing.
Yeah, I want to talk more about mentoring. But first, I'm wondering, you know, I work with startups, but I also work with much bigger companies too. And the bigger companies always want to act more agile and exciting and infuse some of that startup innovation into their big companies. It's really hard to do. It seems to be where great ideas go to die, or at least slow down. What guidance do you have for bigger companies that are trying to keep that innovation alive and act like a startup?
I really just think get out of your own way. Like I don't know what is, it's like an ego disorder. They think that if they make a mistake, that's they're going to be remembered for it forever. No one remembers that burn. Only you. You're the only one that cares. And I don't think they like agility. I think they like to talk about agility. They like to talk about innovation. And they're really afraid to take risks. And and that's a top-down mentality, because that is not true in every company. You see big companies that can do it, and that's a leadership choice. That is a style. The smartest companies create innovation departments and are willing to experiment. They don't have any bias. They don't start sentences with, this is the way it's always been done. People that have never utter those words or start sentences that way, you put them in a special room. You put them in Communitech and in that glassed in area in the center, fill them with students, rotating students, new ideas, people that are unbiased about your competition and your history, and let them be alone and away from the poison. All companies need the people that are well, although, and they need that for sure. But you're going to crush the people that don't even know how to say those words.
That's interesting. I have seen that. I think even those that do that reasonably well, they still struggle with, okay, we've got these walled off, you know, innovators over here, but they've come up with an idea and a concept, and now we're going to go introduce it into the rest of the business. And I think sometimes those innovation groups, they lose credibility, because after a few times there's a big splash and there's new ideas, and then they go into the business and they just don't deliver the results. And so there still has to be that, you know, implementation of it.
Ideas, people are not about results. They're about ideas.
Yeah.
So if that happens, it's because the sales team, it's because the marketers, it's because somebody didn't believe. That smells of a culture that doesn't believe. Celebrate a failure. Everyone, like when innovation was all the talk, you know, and Tony Hsieh and Zappos, and everyone talked about that. Celebrate the failures. Nobody really did that. Nobody wants to celebrate. I celebrate the failures and try, even at Mabel, it was hard to get because there are just some people that cannot do it, but they have to learn to fake it, or they don't belong in a culture that truly believes in innovation.
Yeah, that's amazing, Tricia, because one of the things that you and I did recently, actually you did, was start a business book club. And the book that you started with was Limitless by Jim Quick. You had gathered a bunch of friends and started this book club. Maybe that's a topic for another podcast. But one of the things that I took away from that book, and it kind of ties back to what you were just saying, I think, is that these self-limiting beliefs that we all carry with us and are at the root of the reason why we don't try things or we don't do things. And the realization that these things happen in childhood, which frankly, to me, as a parent of somebody that's got kids that are 18 and 21 now, I'm like, oh my God, what have I done to, you know, place judgment on them or help them or create these self-limiting beliefs that my parents created in me, that my grandparents created in them, etc. But I think that fear of failure, it does go back to that. Like the fact that it's such a part of so many companies means it's a very human thing.
It is. But you got to get over it. There's got to be a way. I don't know if it's ayahuasca or therapy or what it is, but I know if it's about embarrassment. And I think I got over it by just having to. Like when you start a business and your partners are relying on you, and frankly, our husbands did not believe in our business. They thought it was stupid and it was going nowhere. And we could not quit our jobs until it, you know, got to a certain place. And we didn't want to either. We're risk averse. And, you know, we started the business literally with $1,500 each. That was our in to start the business because our families didn't want us taking any more money out of our lives to start this stupid business. And so the fear of failure was real, but to make it work, I had to get over it. You have to go all in. You have to send an email to Brooke Shields' assistant and hope. Like you can't be embarrassed. If you need it to work, you have to be shameless. You know, I have had a lot of failures and that childhood stuff in that book, like I remember sitting outside my grade one classroom with my grade one teacher telling me that I was going to fail. She was going to hold me back from grade one. And the same thing happened in grade eight. My mom had to come. My grade eight teacher wanted to hold me back from high school. Everybody else was in the classroom. They knew damn well I wasn't getting an award out there. So, you know, I definitely should have a little more shame, but I don't know. I just don't. And you can't succeed with it. I see entrepreneurs doing it now even, you know, they want everything to be perfect. They won't launch until it's perfect. You can't afford to. What are you going to do? Sit around and burn money longer? No, you can't afford to. Launch, tweak, fail. No one's going to remember you. Like everybody has got this idea that people care a lot more about their failures than they really do. Mm. You're the only one. And if you can figure out a way to get over it fast, who cares? And if you've got someone in your life that is disappointed in you, that is going to say, I told you so, or look, like I told you not to spend that money. You shouldn't have started this business. So they don't belong in your life.
I love that you're really the only one that cares about your failures and you're the only one carrying this shit around with you for the rest of your life. Everybody else forgets all about it. I also wonder when you say that, was it that experience at Mabel in those early days of just having to do it? Like, did the people that know you best go, where did Tricia find this courage and shamelessness? Like, was it the necessity of not having any choice that brought it out in you, or were you always like that?
No, I think it's just necessity. I think that, no, I don't think, and I think actually the people, so I started the business actually the same year, pretty much, that I moved into this neighborhood where I have tons of friends and they're kind of my grown up life friends. And I think that just became part of my personality. Maybe they think I'm bold and an extrovert. I'm really not. But I just think I have learned to get ahead, to get what you want in life. You can't afford to do that. You're going to just sit and watch TV all day if you're not going to go and make the calls, knock on the door, send the LinkedIn invitations, invite yourself, speak up, all of that stuff. I mean, it's just, I have learned that that's what you have to do. No one's going to wait around to make you successful.
That's amazing, Tricia. You mentioned a couple of times about being a mentor. Did you have mentors coming up? Personally, I can look back. I never had anybody called a mentor. I look back and go, wow, I learned a lot from that person. But I didn't have a coach or a mentor. Did you have that? And what's that been like as you're now putting on that mentor hat and all of a sudden you're the person with all the experience that people are looking to learn from?
Yeah, we definitely did. But yeah, the word didn't exist. That's for sure. But we just knew we needed help. And again, I think it just came from, we couldn't afford to screw it up. You know, even while we were ideation, before I had a website built, I took a very influential class at University of Waterloo by Larry Smith. And it was Econ 220, and it was his first year teaching it. Now, Larry Smith is a very famous prof. His classes are thousands of students now. But at the time, there were like 30 of us in the class, which was a huge opportunity to have just be with Larry and 30 people. So I kind of got to know him. But then, you know, fast forward 10 years, and I'm starting this business. So I just went and knocked on his door one day. Like, I don't know if you remember me, but I'm starting this business. And I don't know if it's a good idea. Like, I had to line up at office hours amongst the students. It was hilarious. And then he shooed all the students away because he thought I was more interesting, which was a win. And yeah, he gave us some advice and he just said, come to me in a year. I want to know what's going on with this. And then we just kept going back to him. And then, you know, he would give us advice. Like he said, you need a better accountant. You're getting screwed around by your accountant. You're making bad choices. He hooked us up with this guy, Bill, who was one of Larry's students also. And Bill is the most amazing accountant. Shout out to RLB. And he is way more than accountant. And so he set us up for success accounting wise and financially and all of that stuff. But then he would also meet with us annually to do strategic planning. And he taught us about budgets and SWOT analysis and skills inventory and stuff that we didn't know about. Like maybe people with MBAs know about that stuff. But Bill basically gave us an MBA for free. He did this just on Saturdays. We would go to his office on Saturdays because we asked. And there are people out there like that. People like Bill are who become mentors. Like I see people in all the programs that I mentor in that I'm like, you're a lot like Bill or just people that are curious. Like Bill's an accountant. He should be worrying about debits and credits and holding companies, but he's also interested in marketing and just success. He's interested in his people, the people in his life being successful. And I think that's what mentors do. The fact that these incubators and accelerators exist, where people can get in for free, where people can get paid to get in, or people can pay a tiny bit of money and have access to all of this, blows my mind. If we had had access to something like Innovation Factory Accelerator Center, we would have been Oprah's favorite thing for sure.
Yeah. And I wonder, one of the things that's occurred to me as I talk, I sometimes talk to people that are looking to get into, you know, customer success or sales in B2B SaaS or get out of it, looking at what's going to happen in the next season of their life. And we explore the things that they're good at, et cetera. One of the things that, and I've found this for myself too, I don't think we have any idea the experience and the skills that we've amassed. Like we tend to think of ourselves as, well, I'm good at this. I think we really do ourselves a disservice. So how does that resonate at all with you? And how does that change how you mentor people?
Absolutely. Like when we first got the call that somebody wanted to buy us, those were also dark days, I will say, because we really were thinking like, God, if we don't have Mabel, what are we? I don't even have a university degree. While I went to university, met a lot of cool people. I wasn't a raging academic success. And I studied economics. I got most of a degree. I think I'm a French credit short. You know, I don't have any other skills. I worked in printing. I've only ever worked in printing. So I was like, what am I going to do? Go run a printer again? Open up a Kinko's? Are these still around? I didn't know what I was going to do. And I really thought I had no useful skills. I don't have an MBA. All the people that I know that give lectures, they have MBAs or I don't know what. And some of my partners felt the same way. And it was hard to think what was going to happen. And so I did take a gap year. Like when I left, I said, I'm going to do nothing for a year. And I just put on my LinkedIn, you know, I'm open to interesting things, only interesting things. And people did call me like immediately. And I don't know, that was a bit of a boost, I guess. The first accelerator I worked for was the Innovation Factory in Guelph, The Forge. And I actually told them, they're like, well, what's your specialty? What can we make you a mentor of? And I said, I can help people with children's products on the internet. I thought that's all I knew how to do. And so I never got any calls. I don't have a lot of children's products, retail products, companies. And I just didn't realize that everything I know about SEO for Mabel is applicable everywhere. Everything I know about PR for Mabel is applicable everywhere. Everything I know about just being aggressive and shameless, entrepreneurial attitude, even a P&L, like it turns out I can read a P&L and spot the problems. I didn't know that. Because I don't have an accounting degree, I just would never think I could be useful there. But as an entrepreneur, you have to do everything.
Yeah. I mean, as somebody that's, you know, seen you work with clients, yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And I think it really helps to, it's a lonely, hard journey, right? They really need to talk to somebody sometimes that they know has been through it. It's sometimes as much about sort of counseling and listening as it is about, hey, here's how to solve your SEO problem, or here's how to drive traffic, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. That definitely is. I do have some sessions where I go to make my notes after and I say, hey, it was just a counseling session. Like it is sometimes just they're lonely. They don't know what to do. They're frozen. They're frozen, I think is the best way to describe it. And it is lonely. And I always tell people when I meet solo entrepreneurs, I pat them on the back and say, good for you, because I know I could never do it. I'm a partnership person. I needed to owe my partner something to get anything done. I needed my partners to call me on my bullshit. I needed my partners to tell me when an idea was way out to lunch, even for me. And if you're doing it by yourself and you don't have that, there's risk there. And it's also like, I can't imagine. So I really always encourage them to find a community, find a tribe. You know, after, I don't know, 10 years with Mabel's Labels in my partnership before, you know, we also kind of didn't get sick of each other. We ran out of things to talk about or whatever, cloistered ourselves in our own specialties. So I did meet this other group of women that owned baby-related businesses and children's products that were awesome. And then also just women entrepreneurs in Canada. And just having those little clusters of people, I think, is really important. And I encourage people to make a retreat out of it. Go away, make it a mastermind. Like, you know, men are very, very good at creating masterminds and joining expensive masterminds and things. And women are less good at it. So, you know what? Call it wine night. Do whatever you got to do. But get together, find your people, and make the time. And it's going to pay off.
You talk about finding people around you to support you, encourage you. I think that's super important. I don't think I really appreciated that until, you know, the last couple of years. But I also think, and you're also really good at this, Tricia, like, let's go out, let's get out, let's get a coffee, let's go get a group of people together. And it takes so much more work now that everybody is kind of more distributed and sitting in their office or their basement most of the day. I don't think we realize how much we miss it. And we have to have somebody to force us to say, yeah, I know you don't want to leave. I know it's just easier to do this on Zoom, but I've never done it and come out of one of those meetings and regretted it.
Absolutely. And I don't do it as much as I used to, but certainly for, you know, an ideas person, product development type person, it was really important for me to spend the time and money to go to things outside of my business. So my partners and I had to agree to budget for that because I needed that. I needed to get out of my business and meet other people and see other people and understand how they thought, learn from people on a stage, just be in a hotel room by myself for 3 nights. I needed that to function. And that is just an expense that was necessary. But I need a change of scenery. I need to be around different people from time to time. And it pays off.
When you say that, it made me think of something else that you and I have talked a little bit about is creativity. And one of those things that we explored in that Jim Quick book was, or maybe just a quick, you know, personal story about it, is that I've just grown up realizing, and maybe it's one of those self-limiting beliefs that was instilled in me early on. It's just, I'm not particularly creative, right? Like I play guitar and I can learn songs, but I've never once written a song. And what I realized was that I can be creative. It just doesn't look or feel like what I think creativity looks like. Like I have these ideas, but they never happen when I'm sitting in this chair. They happen when I'm out in nature, usually walking or biking. And so I've learned I have to have my phone with me so I can talk into it like a crazy person wandering through the woods to capture these ideas. And it's really been empowering for me. There's something about getting out of the area where we spend most of our lives that is just, at least for me, what my flavor of creativity looks like means that I got to get out of here if I'm going to do anything creative.
I agree. I tend to feel like I need to get out of the country, which is a more expensive option, but maybe that's just a self-limiting belief. And that is a self-limiting belief, Bob, because I know that's not true. I think of you as a very creative person. I see you come up with weird ideas. I see the way you decorate your house for Halloween. I've seen you come up with weird costumes that are all in your head. You just show up. Your wife doesn't even know what you're showing up as. So that's funny that you say that because that's not true. Throw that away. Lots of gurus try and teach you to get into a creative space. I don't have that. Like for me, it's about energy. I have, you know, I do a lot of puzzles. And so there are days where I set out the puzzle and I'm not leaving the island until that puzzle's done. And then there are weeks where I just go every once again, move a piece around. You know, some days I'm having obsessive energy. Some days I can't focus on this energy. So it's the same with creativity. Sometimes it's a very creative day. And I'm feeling really good. Like I'll go for a walk in the morning. And if I'm like, oh, this is an idea day, I'll probably cancel some other stuff, do something that will make that happen. For me, you can't force it. I really admire the disciplined people that have learned to find a way to be creative. For me, it happens on that day. It'll happen. I'm pretty random.
Oh, that's awesome. One thing that I wanted to ask about, because One of the things that's happening in the B2B SaaS world is this, maybe it's a resurgence around community. I know Mabel created an incredible community. I want to ask you about that. I guess the reason it ties back to virtually any business is I think that more and more people are looking at building a community that can help their users be more self-sustaining, right? So they don't have to come and rely on us all the time. They need a new template, or they need to have a question, or they're wondering, is this how the solution should work? Now, Mabel, I had never seen anything like it before I saw you do it at Mabel. And I wonder if that's something you specifically did, or something that kind of happened by accident, you jumped on and realized and started to put fuel on. How did that work?
It was very much on purpose because it's free. Again, we started this business with hope and cheese strings. It was free. It was free to get people to talk about us on Facebook. Facebook was growing up at the same time we were growing up. So we jumped on that immediately. Twitter, and then, you know, everything else. And we tried everything. I remember Julie Cole and I sitting in a closet with a little digital recorder, probably in 2005. We were going to make a podcast. We'd heard about podcasting. It was awful. It didn't go anywhere. But we just tried everything that was free. And when we found something we liked, so we liked Facebook. We also found moms liked Facebook. So Facebook was fire for us. And it was, we built our fan base to 100,000, over 100,000 before Zuckerberg wanted money for anything. So we organically reached so many moms. And the community part really comes in that we talk back to them. We, you know, now I see so many companies just treating it like a shouting platform. No, if we posted something and people were interacting, we go back. To this day, people at Mabel's Labels will go back in and say, oh, I'm so glad you like them. Or, oh, can you DM me if they're having a problem? Like, we treat it like a customer service channel. And we do see the super fans answering questions for us, which I love. I don't know why you wouldn't. It's free. It's engaging. It makes people feel brand loyal. And we love it. And it was so much fun. You know, we used to go to these mommy blogger conferences and meet all of the influencers, the bloggers that were talking about us. And sometimes we'd run a contest and take a fan with us. And it was just a lot of fun. And they were our people. Like, we were young moms marketing to young moms. So it was a no-brainer. I think in software, it's probably a little tougher, but I love what I'm seeing with Canva and Notion, you know, allowing users to show off. Like, Canva has all these contests, these design contests that make people feel so proud to be a Canva user. I am sure none of those people will ever go back to Adobe if they ever were on Adobe, because the transition would be really hard. Adobe has a community too, but they're less evangelical. The Canva people are Canva people, and the Adobe people are leaving for Canva.
Right.
And the same thing with Notion, like letting people create these side hustles out of these digital products. And Notion is proud of it. You know, they're competing with them. They sell stuff too. If you can create a whole business off someone else's platform, you're pretty loyal. And then they go on and inspire other people and sell courses. And it's amazing.
Well, yeah. And it's interesting, you know, as mentors that work with some early stage companies, there always seems to be this conversation around, are we B2B or are we B2C? And it seems to be this fork in the road where we have to decide. And I think, and in fairness, sometimes when you're a startup, you do have to pick one because you've got two people and very limited time and resources. But that doesn't mean that you'll always stay in that lane. And I see the lanes and those distinctions becoming a lot more blurry for that reason. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, at the end of the day, it's a human being making the decision. I don't even like the term B2B. I mean, I get that you're selling business products, but at the end of the day, it's a human that decides to make the sale. And so you still need to speak to humans like humans. And no matter what you're doing, like if you're in B2B, you probably go to an annual trade show. You've got to have humans there that can connect with humans walking by. It's still a human business. And you still have to get found in the algorithms. You still need the average human. Even in B2B, people are only going to spend, you know, 5 seconds on your landing page and to see if they make a connection. So it still has to be human eyes and human brains that absorb it and connect with it, not businesses. Businesses do not make choices. Humans do.
Yeah. So it's almost like, okay, it's B2B, but what can we learn from the B2C world and all of that science that's gone into, you know, the customer journeys through a website and communication and personas that, yeah, we do in B2B, but we do it so differently in B2C. I think there's a lot that we can learn from that.
Yeah, I think you have to think about the, so in your business, like let's say, I don't know, can't think of a business, Vidyard. I use that software all the time. So let's say you were in the Vidyard team and you were thinking about personas. I wouldn't think about it as types of companies. I would think about it as types of humans mm-hmm. that are making the choice. So is it a purchasing person? Like at this size company, is it a purchasing person or is it the head of sales or is it the head of consumer experience? Who would buy Vidyard at this company and make a persona for them because it's a human being?
I love that. Okay. I've just got a couple of things left I wanted to cover. One of the things we talk, when we talk about social media, I guess I'm thinking about LinkedIn specifically. And I find this, I know a lot of people that I talk to find this being so overwhelmed by all of the experts and thought leaders on there that seem to have the answers, right? And it creates this sense of, I guess it's imposter syndrome, it's anxiety, like everybody seems to have the answers except me. And I've heard you talk about just go and find one person that you aspire to. Find one person that's running the business that you want to run and copy what they do. I love that advice. Can you talk to me a bit about that?
No, I don't say copy. I say be inspired by.
Okay, sorry.
I don't want to get into trouble. But it's true. Like if you basically, we spend our whole lives trying to be somebody else. Like who do you want to be when you grow up? And that's basically who do you want to be when you grow up? You know, if you're trying to become a professional speaker, who is hitting the stages you want to hit? What are they doing? What are the meta tags in their on their website? What are their photos like? Who do you think they're contacting? How far in advance do you think they're looking at those opportunities? What are they speaking about? What are the keywords they rank for? It's pretty kind of easy. Once you can really focus on who you want to be, you know, so in a business, who do you want to be? I want to be this company. And you look at them and you're like, wow, they are killing it. You should want to be that company. What keywords are they ranking for? What is their website set up? You know, yesterday I met with a company that's maybe making $4 million a year, and they aspire to be this company that's making $25 million. And I said, well, let's look at their website. And oh, look how interesting. They're putting this button here and this. And I said, at $25 million a year, you can be sure they have a UX expert on staff that is tweaking that website every day. Why not just benefit from them paying that person? You know what I always say? If you want the shortest route to success, follow a lazy person around. I am extraordinarily lazy. I will find the shortcut and the easiest path to everything. And that's the shortest path. Be inspired.
Well, yeah. I've been following you around for years. I wouldn't call you lazy, but I think I know what you mean.
I am. I really am. Like I'll find the easiest way to get something done every time.
And I do think having that one expert, you know, sure, they may not be doing everything you need to do, but it's empowering. It's like, okay, I can't follow 20 people.
It is, because if you're looking at everybody.
Yeah, right.
No, especially with advice. Like I give a lot of SEO advice, and I don't call myself an expert because I really think you have to be heads down nerding out 24/7 if you're going to call yourself an SEO expert, but there are some out there. So I say follow Avinash, follow Neil Patel, listen to Gary Vee, just sprinkle some fun into it. Just listen to them and stop listening to everyone else because it's going to be overwhelming. You know, you've got all these people on TikTok trying to sell SEO courses and sign up for this. And they give you a little nugget of information that you're like, that might be true. So you buy their e-class. Well, Neil Patel's not doing that. He's at a different level. And so I don't know if they're the right gurus. That's who I listen to. And that's my advice. It's just listen to a few people. Otherwise, you're just going to be ping-ponging between ideas and you're not going to get anything done.
I'm going to do more of that. I'm going to go find my person. I've got a couple people in mind, but that's great advice. I think everybody could benefit from that. So my last question is kind of what I call my track 8 question. I might have talked to you about this before. I've got this theory. I think both of us are old enough to remember when we'd actually go buy a vinyl record or a cassette. The artist put a lot of thought into this thing's got 12 songs and number one is this and number two is this. And they agonized over that. And now kind of that's all gone because everything just gets shuffled around. But the thing that I noticed always is that the songs that when I would listen to a new album, there were songs that were, people liked them right away. Like, oh yeah, I love that song. And then there were songs, and they were usually around track 7 or 8, which is why I call it track 8. I don't get this. This is weird. I don't like it. But after 20 listens, I'm bored of the first ones, the ones that I immediately liked. And the ones that are my favorite songs 20 years later are the track 8s. And I think this applies to people. It applies to products. And I'm wondering if you can think of anything that's a track eight in your life, whether it's a person or a product or a show or something that, God, you really didn't get it at first, but now you can't live without it.
Gosh, I don't know how to answer that. There probably is something. I don't know. You stumped me. That's a tough one. What would be an example for you?
I don't know. Maybe you're a track eight. You're definitely somebody in my life that I can't imagine living with now. I don't know. Remember how, if we hit it off at first, or if we were like, or you were thinking maybe, so maybe I'm your track eight. I wasn't trying to trick you into telling me you're track eight, my track eight.
Oh, okay. Then you are definitely, I'll give you that. Oh, definitely. Actually, I will say probably all of my answers are people. So this is a terrible way to live. And I understand that, but I do basically go into every room, like, not going to like this person. Here we go. Yep. And you know, I used to joke, except I wasn't entirely, especially in the early days of Mabel when we were so busy. I'd be like, I've got 10 friends. I'll let you know when I have an opening. We cannot be friends. That's just that. I just don't have time. And yeah, I have a pretty bad attitude about human beings. So yeah, when somebody does change my mind, it is amazing. Well, there's occasionally I meet somebody, but then I'm like, I just love them. I love them immediately. But yeah, I've got a pretty bad attitude about people. Dogs. I like all dogs immediately, but people, they're probably all track eights.
Well, Trish, I just want to thank you for this. I want to acknowledge you for all the support and coaching. You really have been a mentor of mine over the last couple of years. I can't imagine my life without you. And I really appreciate you coming here today. I've learned a lot, even from somebody that I've known for as long as I've known you. It's surpassed my expectations. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, well, thank you. And I'm glad you're in my life too. And it's been fun. And I wish you a lot of luck with this podcast. I think it'll be great.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay. Thanks again. We'll see you on the street.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.